between the seats. When we arrive at the Detroit airport, I go into a ladies' room, and there are the wives and daughters. The youngest wife checks the stalls into which the older ones have disappeared, looks me straight in the eye, and smiles. "Hello, Gloria," she says firmly. "My name is Miriam." That smile is worth the whole trip. It's 1996, and I'm in Kansas, home state of U.S. Senator Robert Dole, who has just run for President of the United States. I turn on the television in my motel. Dole is on camera, smiling, talking about his ED, erectile dysfunction, in a paid commercial for Viagra. As Liz Smith, the smart and funny Manhattan gossip columnist, always says, you can't make this stuff up. Just as the millennium is about to end, I'm in a car with two women students on our way to a political meeting in Arizona. We've stopped at a construction roadblock in the searing desert heat, and a big man is walking toward us carrying a pickaxe. Suddenly, we're hyper-aware that no other car is in sight. Leaning into my window, he says he noticed our Ms. T-shirts. He's a Ms. reader. This seems so improbable that I'm sure it's a joke or a con. Then he cites an article of a year ago about Los Feminicidios, the hundreds of young women whose raped, tortured, and mutilated bodies have been found in the Mexican desert across from El Paso. Speculation about the motive has ranged from sex trafficking to the sale of organs, from raping and murdering young women as part of a gang initiation, to a twisted taking of revenge against women for being wage earners. These murders have been going on for decades, but since they are sexualized and the victims are only workers in the maquiladoras, factories just across the Mexican border where products are assembled cheaply for sale in the United States, news coverage has been sensational and arrests have been zero. I noticed tears in this man's eyes. He is saying that 10 years ago, his 16-year-old sister became one of Los Feminicidios, and today is the anniversary of her death. He wants to thank us for paying attention, for remembering. He is grateful to anyone who makes these deaths visible. He himself will remain in mourning until her murderer is caught. We shake his calloused hands. He says there is something mystical about our appearance on this day. We are feeling it, too. As he walks back to his road work, we sit silent for a long time. Over the years, I will forget the larger purpose of this trip, but I will never forget this man and his sister. In 2000, I'm driving with a friend from Texas into rural Oklahoma. I can tell where the first state ends and the second begins because roads get better, cattle roam freely instead of being tethered in the boiling sun, and roadside businesses are more likely to be gas stations with convenience stores than topless bars and entertainment arcades. This seems like a good thing until the Bible Belt gets tighter and I see paired billboards along the road. One promises everlasting life through Jesus Christ. The other promises to reverse vasectomies. During a discussion after a university lecture in the early fall of 2003, a student stands up in the audience and says that President George W. Bush will board a plane carrying a large plastic turkey and fly to Iraq for a Thanksgiving photo op with our troops. Since we've been discussing the phony pretext of weapons of mass destruction with which Bush justified the invasion of Iraq in the first place, the phony turkey gets a big laugh. After Thanksgiving, the press breaks a top secret. Bush boarded Air Force One carrying a big, hand-painted plastic turkey, flew to Iraq in the middle of the war, posed for photos with our troops and the turkey, and flew back to Washington, all at taxpayers' expense. Who was that student? How did he know? While traveling in Georgia, I see lawn signs for the re-election campaign of Max Cleland, a much-admired U.S. senator and a war hero who lost both legs and one arm to a grenade in Vietnam. I'm in Atlanta again in 2002 and see TV ads that call him unpatriotic and compare him to Osama bin Laden and Saddam Hussein. The excuse is only his vote against two of many anti-terrorism measures. This is a Joe McCarthy-type big lie. Veterans in both parties protest the ad, and eventually it is removed. Still, its very extremity has created doubt in a where there's smoke, there's fire way. Cleland is defeated. A year later, I see this successful tactic rolled out nationally against U.S. Senator John Kerry, also a Vietnam War hero, who is running for president. Television ads feature veterans who deny his heroism as a swift boat captain. Though the charges are later disproved, they contribute to Kerry's defeat. Swift boating enters the English language as a verb that means attacking strength instead of weakness. In feminist and other social justice contexts, this has long been called trashing, attacking leaders for daring to write, speak, or lead at all. Taking away the good is even more lethal than pointing out the bad. In the presidential election of 2008, a banner year for surrealism in everyday life, right-wing talk show host Rush Limbaugh opposes the Democratic candidacy of Hillary Clinton. He accuses her of wearing pantsuits to conceal bad legs. Instead, he supports Sarah Palin as the Republican vice presidential candidate because she wears skirts to reveal good legs. Actually, Republicans have nominated Palin at the last minute to pick up some votes from disappointed Hillary Clinton supporters. This makes no sense. Palin opposes reproductive freedom and most other majority needs of women, enjoys shooting animals from helicopters, and has always earned more support from white male voters than from diverse female voters. Her selection is the biggest political mistake since the first President Bush appointed Clarence Thomas to the Supreme Court, expecting to get more votes from African Americans. Surrealism is the triumph of form over content. For serial surrealism, nothing beats right-wing and religious efforts to confer legal personhood on fertilized eggs. This would nationalize women's bodies throughout their childbearing years. Not surprisingly, the Human Life Amendment to the U.S. Constitution has failed, but many state and local tactics are succeeding, from bombing clinics and murdering doctors in the name of pro-life, to denying birth control as a part of health insurance, and closing clinics with impossible building regulations imposed by anti-choice state legislatures. Over time, I've also noticed that local pickets of clinics often personify this surrealism. To enter the Blue Mountain Clinic in Missoula, Montana, I have to pass picketers who are crowded at the edge of the legal buffer zone. They are shouting, "Abortion is murder!" and "Baby killer!" Inside, staff members show me around the clinic, which has been providing a full range of health services since the early 1970s. In 1993, its building was firebombed and completely destroyed by anti-abortion terrorists, even though, as with most such clinics, providing safe abortions is a tiny fraction of its healthcare mission. I understand that repairing the damage has taken 2 years and a lot of work. Now, Blue Mountain is operating behind a slender buffer zone and a tall protective fence. A staff member tells me that one of the female picketers has come in when the men were not around, had an abortion, and gone back to picket the next day. This sounds surrealistic to me, but not to the staff member. She explains that women in such anti-abortion groups are more likely to be deprived of birth control and so to need an abortion. They then feel guilty and picket even more. This restriction on birth control may also explain why studies have long shown that Catholic women in general are more likely to have an abortion than are their Protestant counterparts. When I visit clinics, I've learned to ask the staff if they have ever seen a picketer come in, have an abortion, and go back to picketing again. From Atlanta to Wichita, the answer is yes. Yet because staff members see the woman's suffering and guard her right to privacy, they don't blow the whistle. Meanwhile, in Wichita, Kansas, Dr. George Tiller, one of the few doctors who performs late-term abortions, only about 1% of all procedures, but crucial when, for instance, a fetus develops without a brain, is shot in both arms by a female picketer. He recovers and continues serving women who come to him from many states. I finally meet Dr. Tiller in 2008 at a New York gathering of Physicians for Reproductive Choice and Health. I ask him if he has ever helped a woman who was protesting at his clinic. He says, "Of course. I'm there to help them, not to add to their troubles. They probably already feel guilty." In 2009, Dr. Tiller is shot in the head at close range by a male activist hiding inside the Lutheran church where the Tiller family worships every Sunday. This is done in the name of being pro-life. I'm sitting next to a very old and elegant woman on a plane from Dallas to New York. Assuming that she needs company, I start a conversation. She turns out to be a 98-year-old former Ziegfeld girl who is on her way to dance in an AIDS benefit on Broadway with her 101-year-old friend from Chorus Girl days, something they've been doing since the tragedy of AIDS first appeared. Humbled by this response and looking for advice on my own future now that I'm past 70, I ask her how she has remained herself all these years. She looks at me as if at a slow pupil. "You're always the person you were when you were born," she says, impatiently. "You just keep finding new ways to express it." An organizer's job is surrealistic by definition. I often find myself in front of an expensive painting or amid a sea of designer clothes or in an elegantly furnished room that could pay for dozens of the projects I'm raising money for. This is a crucial part of the job of an organizer. You leave a dark basement and try to explain to people in the sunshine what it's like to live down there. I've learned this is best done by bringing these different groups of people together. Those with extra money discover how much more satisfying it is to see talent and fairness grow than to see objects accumulate. Those without money learn the valuable lesson that money doesn't cure all woes. Instead, it may actually insulate and isolate. I think this contrast between excess and need is the source of anger and joy for most organizers. Anger that it exists in the first place, and joy that the contrast can be diminished. Raising money is the price of our greatest gift. We love what we do. Fundraising is often described as the second oldest profession, after prostitution, though that last should be called the world's oldest oppression. Karl Marx pawned the silverware and jewelry of his wife Jenny, the daughter of a baron, and depended on handouts from the well-to-do Frederick Engels. Harriet Tubman worked odd jobs and passed the hat in churches to support her Underground Railroad, which freed more than 300 enslaved people. Isadora Duncan enlisted her lover, an heir to the Singer sewing machine fortune, to finance her dancing and her trips to a newly communist Russia. Gandhi learned about fundraising and accounting in South Africa and brought both skills to the independence movement in India. Emma Goldman, who started out with $5 and a sewing machine, raised money from such well-to-do supporters as the art collector Peggy Guggenheim. Eva and Ann Morgan, one a niece and the other a daughter of J.P. Morgan, the most powerful financier in U.S. history, used their family's money to finance women workers who were protesting before and after the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire, even putting up a Fifth Avenue mansion as security for bail when those protesters were arrested. The suffrage movement might not have succeeded without the support of Alva Belmont and Mrs. Frank Leslie, two of the few women who gained control of fortunes through widowhood. Wealth next to poverty is surrealistic. Fundraising is pointing that out. It's the end of the 1980s, a time of corporate profits going up and the Berlin Wall coming down. I'm on a private plane to Palm Springs. I know only one of the 10 people on board, the man I'm with. He's one of only two rich men I've dated in my life. The first inherited his wealth, and so was terminally insecure, though he headed his father's book publishing business. Since in my East Toledo neighborhood, reading books was a sign of rebellion, I didn't realize that, for him, books meant conforming. The man on the plane is more secure because he made his own money, yet he has acquired limousine and private plane habits that have begun to isolate him. On the plus side, however, we both love dancing and laughing and have no time to argue about all the things we disagree on. Together with four presidents of major corporations, plus their wives or long-term girlfriends, we're headed for a long Thanksgiving weekend. This is business for the man I'm with, and I hope fundraising from his colleagues for me. The executives on the plane respectively reign over a snack food empire, a pharmaceutical company, a cable channel, and a major credit card company. They just might support health and anti-violence projects for women and girls, who are as much as 80% of their consumers, yet receive only about 6% of corporate charitable dollars. We land at a private airport near Palm Springs and are driven in air-conditioned limos through a scorching hot desert. We arrive at a compound with high stucco walls and double electronic gates. After a security check, we're in the midst of emerald lawns, manicured gardens, and pools of water lilies all drenched by twirling water sprays. In the desert, water is gold. This is Fort Knox. Each couple is taken to a bungalow with its own garden. Men are changing for a fast game of golf, women for tennis. Since I learned neither growing up in East Toledo, a bowling and canasta kind of place, I stay in the air-conditioned bungalow to work on a seriously overdue article. I discover a pantry full of unhealthy snack foods made by one of the host corporations and begin to eat my way through it. Thus begins a time of sports and camaraderie for my companions and writing, air conditioning, and eating junk food for me. Evenings consist of banquets of flown-in food and wine and amusing anecdotes that sound as if they've been told before. For Thanksgiving Day, we've been invited to an afternoon buffet at the nearby desert home of Frank Sinatra and his fourth wife. Our connection is tenuous. It seems the late father of one of the women in our party knew this famous singer. When we arrive, three older men in pastel golf sweaters are watching a football game on television, one with a holstered gun in his belt. Servants bring us rounds of drinks, but our hosts are nowhere to be seen. We're served Thanksgiving dinner from a massive buffet that has all the intimacy of a hotel. Finally, Barbara Sinatra, a one-time Las Vegas showgirl and a former wife of one of the Marx brothers, arrives to greet us. She is a calm and queenly presence. My hope of fundraising rises when she mentions chairing a Palm Springs hospital benefit for abused women and children, but it goes down when she chastises me and the women's movement for not taking up this new-to-her issue. I swallow my pride. I don't have time to explain that the women's movement named domestic violence in the first place, sought its prosecution by police and by new laws, created the first shelters, and has been working for 30 years to explain, for instance, that the moment of leaving is the time when a woman is most likely to be murdered, thus answering questions like, why doesn't she just leave? Instead, I just describe effective survivor-run programs that are in need of support. Still, I can feel her interest strain. For one thing, those programs aren't linked to the charity ball she is chairing, and for another, Frank Sinatra is finally arriving with a drink in his hand. He looks very much like, well, Frank Sinatra. I watch as this queenly woman turns into a geisha serving him turkey. After dessert, our group is ushered into a separate building that houses the largest collection of toy trains I've ever seen. Tracks stretch out on tables that are themselves miniature landscapes with roads, trees, lakes, and tiny buildings. Passenger cars are lighted from within and have tiny people silhouetted in the windows. Sinatra puts on a conductor's hat, presses buttons, and speeds trains through tunnels and over bridges. He looks happy and in his own world. I try not to think about how much all this costs. The next day, back in our lush compound, I return to writing and junk food. Before we leave Palm Springs, there is one activity that I love, riding horses in the desert. However, I discover that the junk food has taken its toll. While I am riding, my jeans split up the back. I retreat to the bungalow for needle and thread. On the plane going home, men talk about mergers and acquisitions, and women talk about weight loss. I know that one wife once had a high-level job in Washington, and another recently climbed Mount Everest, yet neither brings this up. Since we're all in a small place, I try one last time to describe projects that individuals and corporations might well please women consumers by supporting, but I get polite disinterest. I am an isolated island around which an ocean of talk flows. I fantasize about parachuting out of the plane. We land at a private airport in New Jersey. Each couple gets in a separate limousine, though one could have held us all. In 3 days of talk about how to make money, I haven't been able to insert one idea about what to do with it. I'm angry at myself. They are playing the game as it exists. I'm trying to change it, and I've failed. There is little more painful than surrealism when you yourself are the only contrast. I've passed by Laurel, Maryland on trips to and from Washington, D.C. for years, but I haven't a clue what goes on there. Then one day in 1982, when I'm enjoying being at my desk at Ms. Magazine after a long stretch of road trips, I get a call from Connie Bowman, a brand new marketing director at the Free State Raceway in Laurel. Since harness racing is a national and global attraction for the subcultures of racing and betting, and since both subcultures are overwhelmingly male, Bowman wants to attract more women. Her idea is to invite me and Loretta Swit, star of one of the most watched series in TV history, to race each other in an event to be called MASH versus Ms. In return, each of us will get a percentage of the gate to give away. This captures my attention. Ms. Magazine has discovered that very few advertisers will support a women's magazine that doesn't devote its editorial pages to praising the products it advertises, fashion, beauty, home decoration, and the like. To make up for the lack of ads in Ms. and to meet requests for subscriptions from battered women's shelters, prisons, welfare programs, and just readers who can't afford them, we have to raise contributions. This is why I find myself on a warm summer evening, dressed in white pants and green and gold racing silks, standing in front of a huge, blindingly lit stadium filled with thousands of shouting strangers cheering for their favorite horses, plus the novelty bet of Loretta or me. Loretta is wearing white pants plus blue and red silks, and we are both peering out from under white crash helmets emblazoned MASH versus Ms. Beyond us is a huge oval racetrack so preternaturally lit up by Klieg lights that I'm told astronauts can see it from space. Both of us are about to put our lives in the hands of horses and jockeys we don't know. This feels more surrealistic than it sounded on the phone. Officials walk us to our respective rigs. Mine is pulled by a beautiful chestnut mare and guided by a skinny, older black driver. He is unusual in this traditionally white world of southern horse racing. Loretta has a younger white driver and a dark-coated gelding. We each seat ourselves next to the driver on a plank no bigger than an ironing board that is attached to a super light rig. The whole thing is more like a coat hanger than the Ben-Hur chariot I envisioned. As we trot out to the track where other teams are assembled, we already seem to be going very fast. After the starting signal, that speed is much faster. I realize I'm sitting only inches above a track that is whizzing underneath me in a blur. Nothing but the ironing board is between me and being trampled by the horses behind us. Then suddenly, horse, driver, and I are in a capsule by ourselves. A blur of light and wind surrounds us. We are isolated for what could be minutes or hours as one with this powerful horse. I think, racing a car may be about ego, but racing a horse is about trust. As we begin to slow down, The blur sharpens back into trees, stadium, fence, people. My driver turns to me, smiles, and says, "We won." We parade in front of the huge, noisy stadium. An amplified male voice booms out, "Miz beat Mash." He doesn't say that a mare beat a gelding, or that an old black driver beat a young white one, but I hear Loretta saying to a reporter with delight, "The outs beat the ins." Like Alice in Wonderland, I feel as if I've fallen into another universe. I was horse crazy as a child. Now I remember why I loved these smart, sleek creatures that deigned to let us travel with them. Our share of the gate turns out to be disappointing, under $5,000 each. We even forgot to bet on ourselves. Each of us could have raised more money in less time and with way less danger. However, now, whenever I pass the Laurel sign on the way to and from Washington, I have a sense memory of speed and blur, a proud driver, a beautiful mare, a moment of altered reality. It's 1967, and I'm sitting in a diner in rural Virginia, preparing for an interview nearby. Public schools have been ordered to integrate racially, and most white parents have put their kids into newly created all-white private schools that are actually funded with tax dollars by a racist state legislature. My interview is with a sixth-grade white girl who is a prodigy of organizing. She is buzzing around the halls, welcoming black students into this newly desegregated public school. She has her parents' permission, but this was her idea. If I write about her story, I think she might inspire more students to take the lead, but so far, I can't even get past editors. Newspapers say it's apolitical soft news, and women's magazines say it's political hard news. Next to me, at the counter, are three young white guys who are also talking about school integration or, in their words, race mixing. They seem oblivious to the older black waitress who is serving us, and her face is inscrutable. These guys start arguing about Vietnam and whether black GIs will follow orders from white officers. "I hope not," says a solitary older white man sitting down at the counter. "We're on the wrong side in this war." Silence. I wonder if combat will start right here. The older man has interrupted the younger ones at a minimum, and at a maximum, he's talking treason. But, like Scheherazade, who evaded death by telling irresistible stories, the loner moves his coffee mug toward us and begins to talk. In World War II, I was in Indochina. That's what Vietnam was called then. And I didn't just meet Ho Chi Minh. I knew him. We were fighting the Japanese, and so was he. We were allies. Plus, he was our hero because his guerrilla fighters rescued American pilots shot down in the jungle by the Japanese. Ho spent so much time with Americans that sometimes his own men only recognized him by the pack of camels in his shirt pocket. Also, he loved President Roosevelt for pissing off Churchill by saying that colonialism had to end after the war. Ho even knew our Declaration of Independence by heart. It was his model for sending the French colonists home. But after FDR died, everything changed. Truman sold Ho Chi Minh down the river by supporting the French. Otherwise, France wouldn't join NATO. But didn't we also fight a revolution to get rid of the British? Didn't we fight a civil war to keep our country from being split into North and South? Well, that's what Ho Chi Minh is doing now, and we're on the wrong side. There is silence. I can't tell whether the three young guys think this is truth or treason, but they slap money on the counter and drift away. I go over to talk to this man I now think of as the prophet of the diner. He's the first American I've ever heard say what I was told as a student in India long ago, that Ho Chi Minh just wanted independence for his country and would make it a buffer against China. The very opposite of the American belief that Ho's victory would have a domino effect of pushing other Asian countries toward China. At the risk of sounding around the bend, I explained to the prophet that I've read Ho Chi Minh's poetry and he doesn't sound power mad to me. It's part of the reason I keep a sign on my bulletin board. Alienation is when your country is at war and you want the other side to win. He laughs and says he himself went to the State Department to remind them that Ho Chi Minh was once an ally and could be again. Other vets have done the same thing, including a former OSS doctor who treated Ho Chi Minh for malaria. Some have offered to be go-betweens and help bring the United States and Ho together to talk. But as far as the prophet knows, everyone has been turned down. When he learns that I'm a writer from New York, he says, I should write about Ho Chi Minh, who once lived in and loved New York. It's a personal note that might humanize him. I promise to try, but I don't have much hope in the middle of a war. I do some reading. Sure enough, Ho Chi Minh was once a cabin boy on a French freighter. Historians believe he left this job to stay for a while in Manhattan, Brooklyn, maybe also Boston. That was between 1912 and 1918, a time when Trotsky and many other revolutionaries came here. Though America was the home of racism and capitalism, it also had waged the biggest successful anti-colonial revolution. Ho was said to have worked as a pastry chef, maybe a photographer as he later did in Paris, but most of all, he kept writing and agitating for his country's independence. By the end of World War I, Ho had become a recognized leader of independence for his country. That made him a criminal in the eyes of the French, who condemned him to death in absentia. He had so many aliases that when he finally became the leader of North Vietnam, the French recognized him in a photo only by his ears. Yet in 1919, he put on a rented suit and a bowler hat, went to the Versailles Peace Conference, and gave President Woodrow Wilson a petition for the independence of Indochina, based on our own Declaration of Independence. There was no reply. After World War II, he delivered yet another petition to President Truman. Still no reply. For the first issue of New York Magazine, I write an article called Ho Chi Minh in New York. Clay Felker, its founding editor, accepts it on shock value alone. After all, Ho Chi Minh is the enemy leader in an ongoing war that is dividing our own country. In an effort to check facts, I send Ho Chi Minh a telegram. This is surrealism itself. The Western Union operator asks, "Do you have a street address in Hanoi, honey?" Finally, she agrees that Presidential Palace is probably enough. What with the war and all, I think we both envisioned this telegram in our FBI files. I get no answer, but thanks to a kind-hearted woman in the French consulate, I confirm that the French freighter on which Ho worked did indeed dock in New York. Despite his different revolutionary aliases, I find a reference to 2 years he spent living in New York around the time of World War I. I also talked to journalist David Schoenbrunn, who interviewed Ho during World War II and heard him speak with knowledge and affection about New York City. Other American journalists who met him later in Hanoi say that he often ended their interviews by asking nostalgically, "Tell me, how is New York?" I even find his photo in what is said to be Harlem, though the black neighborhood then would have been the Sugar Hill District above 145th Street. There, Marcus Garvey spoke about black pride and anti-colonialism, and leaders from Asia, Africa, and Haiti came to listen. So many independence movements were active in the early 1900s that New York tabloids printed fearful articles about the yellow peril of Asia joining the black peril of Africa to encircle the globe. The young Ho Chi Minh of those days is described in Jean Le Couture's classic biography as slender and beardless, wearing a dark suit, a high-collared shirt, and a small hat perched on top of his head, looking delicate and unsure of himself, a bit lost, a bit battered, like Chaplin at his most affecting. When I walk past old New York buildings he might have seen, I try to imagine him looking at them too. Due to the last-minute chaos and printing problems of the first issue of New York, My article is cut by two-thirds. It becomes so concentrated that readers will have to pour water on it. Still, I hope the prophet of the diner sees it. Now, as I write this almost four decades later, Ho Chi Minh, who owned nothing in his life but a typewriter, remains the only leader ever to defeat the United States in a war. We dropped more bombs on Vietnam than on all of Europe during World War II. About 60,000 U.S. troops died. Twice as many Vietnamese soldiers died. And nearly 2 million civilians in North and South Vietnam lost their lives. Both here and in a now independent, unified, and prosperous Vietnam, where tourists travel, there are still broken families, traumatized veterans, chemicals in the soil, and much more. In South Korea, when I visited in this new millennium, newspaper headlines were protesting Agent Orange, stored underground by the United States on its way to deforesting North Vietnam. Now it was leaking and poisoning the water table. According to the wisdom of Indian country on my own continent, it takes four generations to heal one act of violence. What if Americans had heard the prophet in the diner? In 1978, Father Harvey Egan, pastor of St. Joan of Arc Catholic Church in Minneapolis, invites me to join him on a Sunday morning and give the homily or sermon to his congregation. This isn't as surrealistic as it sounds. He has invited other lay people, from union organizers to peace activists, and at least one woman, Maggie Kuhn, founder of the Grey Panthers. He also welcomes gays and lesbians into his congregation, supports peace movements from here to Latin America, and generally behaves in a way that he and many other Catholics believe Jesus had in mind. Though it's just a coincidence that his church bears the name of a woman who was burned at the stake for being a heretic who wore men's clothes, not for being a witch, as Hollywood told us, I think Father Egan enjoys inviting someone who's been regarded as a jeans-wearing heretic, too. He himself prays to God, the Mother, to make up for centuries of Catholic priests and popes who pray only to God the Father. Needless to say, Father Egan is not a favorite of the Catholic hierarchy, but he has the biggest Catholic congregation in the state. People want to come home to the church of their childhood without having to leave their adult selves behind. There are two churches, as Cesar Chavez, leader of the farm workers, always said, one of buildings and one of people. Father Egan's church is definitely the people. They love him. It's his landlord who is the problem. I'm worried about getting him into even more trouble, since I'm more of a pagan than a monotheist, but pagan just means nature, and Father Egan, too, believes that God is present in all living things. Since most American Catholics live, vote, and act more like the rest of the country than like the Vatican, I figure Father Egan knows what he's doing. I decide to say yes. When I arrive on our appointed Sunday, it is clear Minnesota right-wing groups have been working overtime. Cars are circling St. Joan of Arc with huge blow-ups of fetuses mounted on their roofs, and loudspeakers are blasting, "Gloria Steinem is a murderer! Gloria Steinem is a baby killer!" There are police to keep demonstrators at the distance, required by law, but it is not a peaceful scene. It's also familiar after being picketed over the years. Repetition can take the surrealism out of anything. Once inside, Father Egan tells me not to worry. The positive response has been overwhelming. There is a waiting list, even after he doubled the capacity of this large church by holding two masses. The news that I'll have to speak twice makes me more nervous than the presence of protesters. As I wait alone in the cavernous space, stage fright hits in a very big way. A pulpit in a Catholic church is nowhere I ever expected to be. My heart thumps, my mouth gets dry, my mind goes blank, and I wish I were anywhere but here. Father Egan finishes introducing me, lifts his arms so his vestments billow out like a butterfly, and says with a mischievous smile, "Glory be to God for Gloria." The congregation bursts out laughing, and so do I. Suddenly I feel okay. Laughter is a rescue. I'm not talking about the Catholic position on abortion. Most people here have their own ideas, and thanks to honest Jesuit historians and to Catholics for a Free Choice, now called Catholics for Choice, they may well know that the Catholic Church not only didn't oppose abortion, but actually regulated it until the mid-19th century. It was made a mortal sin, mostly for population reasons. Napoleon III wanted more soldiers, and Pope Pius IX wanted all the teaching positions in the French schools, plus the doctrine of papal infallibility, so they traded. Also, Catholicism is hardly alone among patriarchal religions in controlling women's bodies. Patriarchy evolved as a way of giving men control over women's bodies and reproduction. It seems more helpful to talk about what came before patriarchy and could show us a way beyond it. So, I talk about original cultures that saw the presence of God in all living things, including women. Only in the last 500 to 5,000 years, depending on where we live in the world, has godliness been withdrawn from nature, withdrawn from females, and withdrawn from particular races of men, all in order to allow the conquering of nature, females, and certain races of men. Though patriarchal cultures and religions have made hierarchy seem inevitable, humans for 95% of history have been more likely to see the circle as our natural paradigm. Indeed, millions still do, from traditional Native Americans here to original cultures around the world. The simple right to reproductive freedom, to sexuality as an expression that is separable from reproduction, is basic to restoring women's power, the balance between women and men, and a balance between humans and nature. So when Father Egan prays to a female as well as a male God, and invites women as well as men to speak from the church pulpit, he is taking a step toward restoring an original balance. My homily seems to go over just fine. People nod at the idea that when God is depicted only as a white man, only white men seem godly. They laugh at the idea that priests dressed in skirts try to trump women's birth-giving power by baptizing with imitation birth fluid, calling us reborn, and going women one better by promising everlasting life. Indeed, elaborate concepts of heaven and hell didn't seem to exist before patriarchy. You just joined your elders or kept being reincarnated until you learned enough. There is the laughter of recognition. Altogether, I sense curiosity and openness, not hostility or opposition. As people leave, there is a long line to shake hands, to share comments, and to thank, even to bless Father Egan and me. He asks me to call him Harvey. I think we both feel bonded by this experience of both opposition and support. Outside, the cars with pictures of fetuses are still circling, and bullhorns are still blaring. Minnesota is home to the Human Life Center, a think tank headed by the delightfully named Father Marx, who often warns that the white Western world is committing suicide through abortion and contraception. His use of white Western is a big clue to the reasons for preserving patriarchy and controlling reproduction. But still, the parishioners streaming out of St. Joan of Arc don't seem alarmed. This isn't their first brush with local extremists. Harvey and I feel we have dodged a bullet. In New York a few days later, I hear the news that Archbishop John Roach, Harvey's superior in the Catholic hierarchy, has reprimanded Father Egan and apologized in public for him. This is a big deal. It's all over the media, from the front pages of newspapers in Minnesota to national television. The next time I see Harvey is 2 days later, on a TV screen. He is a disembodied head being interviewed in a Minneapolis studio by CBS Morning News. I am sitting in a studio in Washington, D.C. Neither our TV questioners nor the reprimanding archbishop ever quote anything I said or cite any complaints from parishioners. The controversy is entirely directed at my being invited to give the homily at all. I'm worried that I've endangered Harvey, but when I phone him, he seems to be his usual gentle and unrepentant self. From now on, he explains, he is supposed to invite speakers only from a list of names pre-approved by the Archdiocese. Later, I read his response to a reporter. So far, they have found Mickey Mouse, Little Lord Fauntleroy, Peter Rabbit, and Lawrence Welk. I laugh and stop worrying. Then a couple of weeks later, I'm in my apartment between travels, sitting peacefully with my cat on my lap, drinking my morning coffee, and I pick up the New York Times. Above the fold on the front page, a place usually reserved for wars and presidential elections, there is a headline, "Pope forbids homilies by lay people." Nothing in my life quite prepares me for feeling directly addressed by the Pope. I try to talk myself down. After all, many lay people have given the homily. Maybe I'm just being paranoid, and call a reporter who covers the Vatican. He says that at a minimum, Father Egan and I have provided what is known in the media, and perhaps also in the Vatican, as a news peg. After that, Harvey is almost always present whenever I visit Minneapolis. He turns up because we really do like each other, and I think also because he's protecting me. Whether it's a campus lecture or a YWCA benefit or a political rally, there he is, beaming from the sidelines with kindness, friendship, and his trademark enthusiasm. Though the controversy never quite goes away, he isn't in the least put off by it. He also works around the Pope's dictate by renaming the homily a Sunday presentation and inviting lay people his congregation admires. He remains public about his support for women and their participation in the liturgy, for artificial birth control, for the right of conscience that actually does exist within Catholicism, and for peace and justice movements around the world. Even far from Minnesota, Catholics tell me he provides hope amid the hierarchy. When Harvey retires in 1986, St. Joan of Arc is still the most popular Catholic church in his and many other states, with 1,000 people attending every Mass. Father Egan continues to write about everything from the injustice of current wars to the past and future of Catholic mysticism. In the Catholic Reporter, he publishes an article titled "Celibacy, a Vague Old Cross on Priestly Backs," and explains that it started only in 1139 when the church no longer wanted to be financially responsible for the children of priests. He opposes the so-called Human Life Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, even though the Catholic bishops advocate it. Prohibition was a disaster, Harvey explains, and we shouldn't be pushing for another constitutional amendment based on a moral conviction. In 2006, at the age of 91, Harvey's unique life comes to an end. It's been 28 years since he invited me to give the homily. Yet whenever I'm in Minneapolis, I always feel he's just around the corner. I miss him. In his honor, I try to be as courageous and outrageous as he was. I add to speeches something I learned from historians of religious architecture, but left out of my homily. The design of many patriarchal religious buildings resembles the body of a woman. Think about it. There is an outer and inner entrance. Labia majora, labia minora, with a vestibule between, an anatomical as well as architectural term, and a vaginal aisle up the center of the church to the altar, the womb, with two curved ovarian structures on either side. The altar, or womb, is where all male priests confer everlasting life, and who can prove that they don't? This surrealism of patriarchy goes on after Harvey's death. In 2012, the Vatican announces an investigation, not of the sexual abuse of children by priests that has been exposed as epidemic, but of the Leadership Conference of Women Religious, a group that represents 80% of the nuns in North America. They are accused of asking for greater decision-making roles in the church for themselves and for women in general, of remaining silent on homosexuality and abortion, of spending too much time working against poverty and injustice, of promoting radical feminist themes incompatible with the Catholic faith, and of supporting President Obama's health care legislation that includes birth control. Indeed, the success of that health care bill seems to have been the last straw. Some members of Congress cited support for the bill by nuns as giving them the courage to vote against the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, which was the major force opposing the bill. The Vatican investigation declared that bishops are the church's authentic teachers of faith and morals. As the Bible says, rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. Even I am surprised to find this is so literal. The name of the Vatican body investigating the nuns is the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, the same body that conducted the Inquisition, which came to be known as the Holocaust of Women, because as many as 8 million women healers and leaders of pre-Christian Europe were killed by torture and burning at the stake over more than 500 years. Chief among their sins was passing on the knowledge of herbs and abortifacients that allowed women to decide whether and when to give birth. After a period of shock and conferring, the Leadership Conference of Women Religious issues a statement. It condemns unsubstantiated accusations, offers to go to the Vatican for a dialogue, and observes that just by following the teachings of Jesus, many in the church might also be called radical feminists. Also, some of the nuns get their rebellious act together and take it on the road. They begin touring the country to highlight poverty and injustice and become known as the nuns on the bus. I start to see men and women of all descriptions wearing t-shirts that say, "We are all nuns now." If Harvey were alive, he would be wearing one too. A few years later, I'm waiting for a friend on a snowbound street in Minneapolis. A skinny boy of 12 or 13 with a backpack almost as big as he is standing nearby. I realize he's trying to get up the courage to say something, so I say hello. All in a rush, he says he knows I was at St. Joan of Arc Church. It's where his family goes. He's part of a group there called Awakening the Dreamer, and it's trying to help indigenous tribes save the rainforest. He wants to go to Latin America one day, just like Father Egan did. I look at this boy, who wasn't born yet when I spoke there. Maybe his parents weren't born yet either, and ask how he knows me or Father Egan. He says he read all about us on the big St. Joan of Arc website. I realize it's a new day. It turns out that his family are Hmong refugees from Laos, people who were first displaced by the Vietnam War. Though Minneapolis has been mostly blonde and Scandinavian in its immigrant past, it now has become the American city with the largest Hmong population. Indeed, I've read that a Hmong woman has just been elected to the city council. I ask him why he cares about such a long-ago event. He says he's shy. His parents have a hard time with English. He is trying to help them and also to speak up in school. He read on the church website that I was the most protested speaker Joan of Arc ever had, and he wants to speak up for his family. I tell him that he just took that power. Now no one can ever take it away. I also tell him that the rainforest is beautiful, like where his family came from, that Father Egan would be proud of him, and that I am proud of him too. The first step toward speaking for others is speaking for ourselves. As I watch him trudge off in the snow, I think for the millionth time, you never know. Chapter 7. What Once Was Can Be Again. I used to think there were only two possibilities. The first was what many believed, that equality between males and females was impossible and contrary to human nature. The second was what many hoped, that equality would be possible in the future for the first time. After the Houston conference and spending more time with women and men from Indian country, I thought there might be a third. This balance between females and males had existed in the past, and for a few, it still did. There were people to learn from. When new people guide us, we see a new country. It's the fall of 1995. I'm at the Columbus, Ohio airport, waiting at the baggage claim as instructed. I'm going to speak at a conference of the American Indian Science and Engineering Society, a national group that teaches Native students science and engineering by using Native examples, thus allowing them to excel without feeling they have to abandon their history and cultures. Since Native students often prosper in cooperative rather than competitive classrooms, as do a lot of female students regardless of where they come from, I've been asked to talk about the feminist movement and efforts to change classrooms into learning circles. Actually, boys too often do better when they aren't always in a hierarchy, so the ideas of this group could improve education in general. After a few minutes of waiting, I notice a heavyset man in a windbreaker leaning against the wall. I walk over and ask if he's waiting for me, and he is. Holding up a sign seemed like an invasion of privacy, he says, so he's been waiting patiently for the crowd to thin out. On the long drive to the conference center, we pass a turnoff with a small sign, Serpent Mound. I ask what this is. He doesn't seem surprised, but he just explains that it's an ancient earthwork, one of the many around this country. Some are shaped like enormous birds and animals, others are circles or pyramids. Some are as tall as a three-story building and surrounded by 100 smaller mounds you can see only from the air. This one is a snake about 3 feet high and a quarter of a mile long, the oldest surviving mound of its kind, maybe 2,000 or 3,000 years old. I'm into my third decade of traveling around this country, and I know none of this. I tell him my family comes from southern Ohio, yet the Serpent Mound is news to me. As if to make me feel better, he says he has friends who went to England to see Stonehenge, and when he asked if they would like to see even older sites here, they said no. He says this not with an edge, but with a smile. Because I ask, he tells me that the mounds around this country were spiritual centers or astrological observatories or burial sites. Most are pyramids with openings inside for viewing solstices and equinoxes, but others are flat mounds at global magnetic points where seeds are spread out to make them more fruitful. All were centuries in the making, with digging up and moving tons of earth. Sometimes those basins were turned into lakes or fish hatcheries. Burial mounds tell us the most because they contain seashells from the Gulf of Mexico, or obsidian from Wyoming, or carved mica from the Carolinas, or even the teeth of Rocky Mountain grizzly bears inlaid with pearls, also bowls and jewelry made of silver and copper from Canada, turtle shells from the Atlantic, carved semi-precious beads from Central America, and textiles from everywhere. They tell how far the ancients traveled or traded. By now, I feel like I'm in an alternate reality. He says the mounds were such feats of construction that Europeans didn't believe people they regarded as savages could have ancestors who created them. One popular theory was that the Egyptians lived here and then mysteriously left. Another was that the Chinese, the first sailors, had come and gone. I ask if the mound builders were his ancestors. He says they might have been, but with all the mixed heritage in this country, they could be my ancestors too. Nobody knows what they called themselves. The mounds are named after the places they were found, Adena, Hopewell, and so on. Most of the big mounds were along the Mississippi River. People on this continent, then known as Turtle Island, had cultures as advanced as any on Earth. Suddenly, it seems ridiculous that we just came from a city airport named for Columbus, a terrible navigator who insisted to his dying day that he was in India, which is why people here are called Indians. As the native women in Houston said, it could have been worse. He could have thought he was in Turkey. If you've been genocided and left out of history, as they explained, You need a sense of humor to survive. When I tell my host this, he looks at me as if I'm just beginning to get it. Though I've been assuming this kind and patient man was sent to pick me up, I realize I don't know his role.